At home, I bought about a half a century ago over in Alton, Illinois. I just happened to see it on the bookshelf. I'd heard of it for years, but never had seen one. And back then, you didn't just look them up on the internet and order them. You had to be where a physical copy was, or you just didn't see it. So I still remember paying $5 for that brand new book. It's just a beautiful, because it not only had the text in print, but it also had facsimiles of Jefferson's original razor job, where he'd taken a New Testament and just cut it all to pieces and kept the parts that he wanted. That showed the audacity of the man. But he was a child of the Enlightenment, and so he thought he was doing a good turn just to preserve the moral teachings of Jesus. Well, we saw this morning that Jesus was more than just a great moral teacher. And at the end this morning, we were talking about the resurrection. That was the place I wanted to conclude because of the day. And I said this morning that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the greatest fact of all time. I believe that. If it's not the greatest fact of all time, then it's one of the most vicious, wicked hoaxes, one of the most heartless things that's ever been foisted upon the minds of men, because it's brought so many people to a false hope over the years. Most religions are based on philosophical ideas. There are very few religions that are based on personalities. Of the three major world religions that are based on personalities, only the Christian faith claims an empty tomb for its founder. Judaism is regarded as having been started by Abraham, generally speaking, about 1900 years before Christ. But Judaism never claimed that Abraham rose from the dead. The original accounts of the Buddha never claimed that he arose from the dead. And the original accounts of Muhammad never did either, after he died in 362 A.D. So Christianity is the only one that has claimed an empty tomb for its founder from the very inception of the religion. And the Christian faith stands or falls with the resurrection. Disprove the resurrection and you have disposed of Christianity. It's either the greatest miracle or the greatest delusion of all time. This is the doctrine that turned the world upside down in the first century. Now, I want to have some discussion with you before we go very far, because I've heard repeatedly that that helps in the afternoons. Those of you who have a hard enough time staying awake in the morning have a worse time in the afternoon, and that's all right. I don't mind. I take it as a vote of confidence myself. Brian read for us this morning from 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul there reiterates that if the resurrection of Christ is not true, he says six things are true. If Jesus did not rise from the dead, then the apostles are liars. The message is an empty message. Your faith is vain. You're still in your sins. Your loved ones are gone forever. And we're of all men most miserable. Those things, those six things are true if Jesus did not rise from the dead. I mentioned this morning a telling statement that Jesus never predicted the fact that he was going to die without adding the fact that he would rise. That's something that only a fool would say if he planned to have a long reputation and if he didn't know that he was absolutely going to rise. I should mention before we go any further that there are natural prejudices against believing in a resurrection. One of them is theological. A lot of people who claim to be Christians in our time and who go the way of the modern scholars that Jack was talking about during the class this morning, many of these people, theologically speaking, don't think it matters whether Jesus rose from the dead. They don't believe that he did. They think it was a spiritual resurrection, whatever that means. I don't even know what that means. I don't think they know what it means. They don't care what it means. It's just the idea of a resurrection rather than a bodily resurrection. So there is a theological prejudice against the resurrection of Jesus sometimes. It doesn't matter whether he rose, it's just as long as you follow him and believe him. He lives through you, and that's maybe all the resurrection there is. There's that theological prejudice, and then there's also the scientific prejudice that since you and I have never seen somebody rise from the dead, that it must not have happened 2,000 years ago either. So as I said this morning, we need to examine the evidence. And this is where I want your help as we think through this. The first major statement here to make is that Jesus was dead. Now, there is a swoon theory that says that Jesus did not really die on the cross. He just lapsed into a comatose condition and seemed to be dead. And in that pre-scientific era, they only thought he was dead. And so they buried him as if he were dead. But in the cool of the tomb, he came back to his senses. And then he came out and convinced everybody that he had risen from the dead. And that's all the resurrection there is. What would you say to somebody if you were studying with them and they purported to, they used that theory, that Jesus didn't really die, they only thought he was dead, but he came out and they thought he had resurrected? What would you say if somebody said? Who rolled away the stone? That's an excellent point, because just think of the loss of blood, think of the bodily injuries that Jesus has had, enough to appear to be dead. And then he gets up in the dark of the tomb. There was no light in there. And he feels his way around in the crevices and finds that stone, which three women did not feel capable of moving with their combined strength. Who's going to roll away the stone for us, they said, because they didn't think they could do it by themselves. This half-dead man rolls that stone away and then is able to come out. So the stone is one big impediment there. What else?
Well, the trauma of the Roman scourging, Jesus couldn't even carry the beam.
Right. But yet he wakes up in the tomb, comes out, and walks 7 miles over to Emmaus on feet that have just had a spike driven through them. You know.
Well, he had his hands punctured.
Yeah.
Side up through his heart, you know, and released the blood.
Right.
I mean, that was evidence.
Separated blood and water is strong medical evidence of death. And this was all seen by Roman soldiers who knew a dead man when they saw one. This was not their first rodeo. They knew he was dead. They had examined him because they needed to know whether to break his legs or not. So it's not like somebody who's never been around a corpse before to say, he looks dead to me. These were experienced men. As usual with most of these theories, if you can believe that Jesus did not die but came out and convinced everybody that he had died, you should have no trouble believing in the resurrection. It's a lot easier to believe just what the Bible says than to try to make attempts in the name of trying to be rational. You become the least rational person in the room. It's impossible that a half-dead being with those deadly wounds and also those constrictive grave clothes, that wouldn't be an easy thing to get out of either. You'd have to find some way, you know, your arms are down to your sides. You'd have to find some way to get out of the grave clothes. Plus, when they came, go ahead, Dale.
There's also soldiers in front of you.
Exactly right. Right.
They're a guard.
There's a seal placed on the tomb, and they're guarding it. Even if he was able to move the stone, which I'm not at all convinced that he could have, they're going to hear that. That would make a grating sound in the trough. Plus, when they came and dressed the body, they put a weight of probably at least 80 pounds of spices on his chest. And you got to get out from under that in your half-dead condition.
All those who witnessed the crucifixion were convinced he was dead.
Right. Right.
Testimony of Pilate.
Right. Right.
Well, the testimony of over 500 people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a collusion that is impossible.
Right.
Someone would have recanted.
Right. There's never been one like the resurrection of Jesus. They always broke down. There's a difference between what we might call a resuscitation and the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus, for example, raised Lazarus from the dead. There are a number of that type of thing in the Old Testament, whatever you want to call them, beginning quite early in the days of Elijah and Elisha. Dead people coming back to life. Jesus did at least three of those himself during his public ministry. But those people were always subject to death again. There was even a plot to kill Lazarus. And Lazarus eventually died again. Jesus was the first fruits of them that slept in that sense, 1 Corinthians 15:20. He was the first fruits of them that slept in that he was the first one to come back from the dead, never to die again. Death hath no more dominion over him. Okay, good. Was there another question, comment, or thought on that? Okay, I don't think he would have been capable in a half-dead condition of convincing anybody that he'd risen from the dead as the Lord of life and the conqueror of the grave. So, yeah, Jack.
One of the Gospels, I thought it was John, mentioned that the Jews bribed the guards to say that the disciples came and stole them. It would have been no need if he had swooned or if they could have produced a body.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Anybody else? Okay, let's talk about some of those other theories. Sometimes people have kind of an elaborate idea about what might possibly have happened to the body of Jesus. They get pretty far out in left field sometimes. But let's think of that one where they said that the disciples stole the body. What can you say in answer to that when they say the disciples stole the body?
Where did they put it?
Yeah, where did they put it? Why don't you produce it if it was stolen? That's one of the key pieces of evidence that never came up. If the body of Jesus has been moved, somebody knows where they moved it to, produce the body, string it up on the flagpole in the middle of the Jerusalem, and all this preaching about the resurrection is going to evaporate away. There's not going to be any Church of Christ because there he is dead, maggot food. Also, the Roman soldiers that were bribed were the ones who made this claim. And their claim was that they were asleep. While we were asleep, the disciples came and stole the body. So how do you know what happened while you were asleep?
If they were admitting that, weren't they signing their death?
They were. The Jews may have made arrangements, possibly, about that. Yeah, Dale.
Well, all the apostles, even his own, like you said this morning, his brother, they changed their thinking after he was dead.
And not a one of them recanted.
The body did it, and now we're going to pursue this cause. They were convinced he was raised from the dead. A complete change of attitude. Nothing else would cause it, I don't think.
I don't either. And especially the fact that there was no deathbed confession. Well, we really made it all up. It was all a hoax. If somebody's going to perpetrate a hoax like that, often they will recant or tell the truth. There'll be a memoir that comes out later, or at least a deathbed confession. But of all these people that were involved, there was never any of that. Kyle.
I was reading that historian's take on, he was trying to find the historical Jesus. He said the best evidence that Christ lived was Christianity itself. Because, like, there's a number of personality religions or cults that are real. Buddhism, you mentioned a couple of them. And, you know, those guys lived, and we see the results of their work. So he said Christianity itself is the best evidence that Jesus lived.
Yeah.
This writer was an agnostic. He said what's confusing to him is that after his alleged resurrection, we don't see Jesus going to Rome and establishing franchises of his cult.
Yeah.
So he was like, so he said it's a weird case of these people believing that he had resurrected and then being excited enough to spread it all around the world. That was confusing to him.
Yeah. Well, it certainly doesn't operate according to the wisdom of man. The wisdom of man would have said, yeah, have your franchises all around, show the risen Lord. But this was going to be a validation of faith. You either believed or you didn't. Jesus did not bend over backward beyond his miracles to convince everybody. He knew that faith is based in part upon our will. We can will to believe, or we can will not to believe. If I don't want to believe the Christian faith, I can invent reasons not to believe it that are cogent to me. He didn't overwhelm us with evidence. There is enough evidence to make an honest observer believe, but But if we approach it with a jaundiced eye, then there never could be enough evidence. So he appeared to his apostles and others who knew him best for a period of 40 days, and then he left and left it to the apostles and the other followers to continue on the work. And there was no plan B. So that's an excellent point. Ed.
All my life did wonder if I could ever convict a man of a crime. Well, I sat on a murder trial in the jury, and you listen to the evidence. Some of it is reasonable and evidentiary. There's this, this, and this, and this solid, plus eyewitnesses. Then you hear others, and it doesn't ring of any truth. It conflicts with the evidence. And so, yes, I can look at evidence and reach a verdict.
Right.
When and I mention this because, to me, it comes down to believing the testimony and the evidence and the reasonability of it. And what's the, on the other hand, it doesn't make sense. You kind of mentioned that this morning.
Right.
And that's mainly why I believe it, because there's a ring of truth, it's reasonable, and then there's these milestones of evidence.
Absolutely.
And that's it for me.
Me too.
I can't explain it, a lot of it.
Right.
But it's true.
Right. And yet we still accept it on faith. He doesn't come and shove it in our face. He wants us to accept it on faith, because without faith, it's impossible to please God. There's something about that trust that is pleasing to God. And that has to do with our attitude and our mindset as much as it has to do with the evidence. He never expects us to believe something that's incredible. He gives us evidence for what he wants us to believe, but he doesn't push us on that. We can still make up our own mind. Jack.
One more piece of evidence.
Yes.
That is Paul himself. His manner of life, he was trying to stomp out the church.
Right.
Nobody could touch him. Nobody could bribe him. Nobody could convince him of the truth but Jesus. And if Jesus was still in the tomb,
right. Excellent point. Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It's hard for you. The Lord knew him, and he came to know the Lord. Excellent point. Anybody else have a question, comment, or thought at this point? Okay, you're doing very well with that. It doesn't make any sense to say the disciples stole the body. That was one of the most preposterous lies that was ever told. Now, what about the idea that the Jews stole the body? What would you say if somebody said that the Jews stole the body? After all, he caused a lot of trouble while he was around. We don't want people venerating his grave, so we're going to take his body off somewhere else. And this won't be his grave anymore. David?
I think they knew of his foretelling that he would be in the grave 3 days. That's why they put a guard there. Because they didn't want that to happen. They didn't want his apostles to come and steal the body and say, see, he did rise from the dead. So it wouldn't have made sense for them to do what they didn't want to happen.
Right. Right. The Jews would not go against the Romans in this. The Romans had cooperated with them even to the point of crucifying Jesus. And if the Jews did steal his body, then when the resurrection was preached again, why didn't they produce the body? That would have squelched the resurrection right at the beginning.
They would have
it hanging on the main gate. Exactly. Up where everybody can see it, so everybody can know what the score is. What would you say if somebody said, and I had a young man postulate this possibility down in the basement one time. He said, what if grave robbers stole the body? What would you say to that?
Why?
Yeah. Why? How did they get in past the Roman guard? Why did they pick that tomb? Was it a random picking of the tomb for the challenge of getting by the guard? Were they thrill seekers? You know, most thrill seekers of of graves, of grave robbers, they want everybody to know what they've done, and so they will find a way to exhibit their exploits. They used to take corpses and put them up on the fence of the graveyard years ago because they wanted everybody to know that they'd done it. David?
Most grave robbers, I think, are after the loot.
That's true.
And it was known that this was a poor man who not had possessions.
Right.
If you were going to rob a grave, you'd rob a rich man's grave.
That makes sense.
Because there was a rich man who wanted to buy.
What was that? I'm sorry? Yeah, and the rich man who wanted to help out with the burial is the one that gave his new tomb where nobody had been buried before. Well, what if we postulate that the women early on that Sunday morning came to the wrong tomb? It was sort of half light, and they were in an emotional state. So they were wrought up, so they came to the wrong tomb and only thought that this empty tomb was the place where Jesus had been buried. What would you say to that?
Well, there again. Go to the right one.
Yeah, exactly. Go to the right one. That gardener can maybe point out the right tomb to you. If it's dark enough to make that kind of a mistake, it would have been too dark for the gardener to be there working anyhow. If it's light enough to work, then surely the women were not mistaken. And again, why didn't the Jews produce the gardener, the one the women thought was the gardener? Why wasn't the real tomb of Jesus pointed out?
You still have the problem with the garden.
Exactly. Same issue on many of these. What about those who say that Joseph of Arimathea moved the body? It was his tomb. He could do what he wanted with his tomb. Did Joseph of Arimathea move the body?
Well, you're only talking a day and a half.
Short period of time.
Why go to that trouble at all?
Right. Plus, we know that the body was there up until a certain point. The body would have had to have been moved between the close of the Sabbath and the first sign of dawn on the first day of the week. So if it's your tomb and everything's above board, why do you move it secretly to a better place if there was a better place?
And then there's those pesky guards.
Yeah, exactly. The guards that were placed there because the enemies of Jesus wanted to make a point indeed are the point for much of this discussion. Plus, why would Joseph want to remove the body? He already went to great extent to get Jesus right, to get the body of Jesus right where he was. He was a disciple. He was devoted enough to cast his lot with the Christians by asking for the body. And with such reverence for Jesus, what better place than his own unused rock-hewn tomb? And again, if he moved the body, just produce the body. Simple.
And there's that prophecy about being in a rich, buried with rich men, in a rich man's
grave. Right. Isaiah 53.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah. In Isaiah 53 alone, there's a whole bunch
and
of stuff.
Jesus had no control over it.
Right.
I mean, if you take his last 24 hours of life,
right.
A lot of those prophecies, I don't know, there's 34 prophecies right in that. I don't think he had control over
right.
very many of them.
He didn't. No. He wasn't in the driver's seat.
No.
Kyle.
When Paul says we do not follow cunningly devised fables.
Peter.
What do you think he's specifically referring to? All the prophecies Jesus fulfilled and the apostles were making sure that Jesus matched all those? Or was he talking about Greek systems? Or?
I think he included it all.
I
think so. Yeah. Because there were a lot of people who thought that that's exactly what Christianity was. They hadn't examined it. Yeah.
So I was thinking about if you're trying to write someone's story and make them fill all those prophecies and types and shadows, I mean, there must be hundreds and thousands
right.
of things that Jesus matched up with.
Right. It is. It would have been impossible for any one person to have controlled that. And many of the things that happened would have been impossible for anybody to control it. And yet you have all of these hundreds of prophecies, or approximately 330 prophecies over his whole life experience here on earth. They all are arrows pointed at the same bullseye, and they all hit the same target. It becomes the more remarkable, the more you think about that. What would you say to somebody who said, well, I think the Romans moved the body? We have several of the same issues.
It would have been in their mission to show the body and put that rebellious sect that's causing so much strife among the Jewish elite, put that to rest. That was there.
Right. And Pilate was a very obstinate character. He only wanted peace, and he wouldn't even alter the inscription above the cross. And again, no remains were produced. One time I had a young man say that he thought that maybe an earthquake swallowed up the body. Stones moving around and earthquake swallows up the body. What would you say to that?
That would have been written.
The fact that there was an earthquake of that magnitude would have been recorded. And Nina?
What about the napkin?
Exactly, yeah. What about the napkin and the grave clothes? How does an earthquake take the body but leave a cocoon of grave clothes? Exactly.
We believe that because that's what the Bible says.
Right. And that's the best evidence. Best evidence we've got.
Well, the Jews would have published that. You know,
right.
It's not there.
Right. And how far away is it if the earth opened up? I mean, you could surely dig down and get it. So that was what a young man said to me one time, and I thought it deserved an answer, but it's really not much of an answer in itself. The grave clothes were lying as though the body had just withdrawn itself. And the grave clothes were in an undisturbed condition. And that napkin apart in a place by itself. Kind of, I visualize the grave clothes as a discarded butterfly cocoon. And that speaks of a miraculous leaving of those grave clothes.
What happened to the spices?
Yeah, what happened to the spices? Excellent point. There's a lot to consider in this. Somebody said one time maybe the wrong body was placed in the wrong grave, and all I can say to that is what happened to the body that was there. Remember, Joseph of Arimathea had specifically asked for the body that was the body of Jesus. Nicodemus helped prepare it for burial. They had seen Jesus many times. They knew him. They knew that this was his body. There's no question but what it was Jesus of Nazareth who died and was buried. Somebody said one time that maybe the body of Jesus just disappeared because somebody did some witchcraft. What would you say if these get wilder? What would you say if somebody said that to you?
Well, why would Satan or those forces?
Exactly.
Satan just becomes easier to.
Exactly. When you say witchcraft, you have left the naturalistic type of explanation. So you're already in the realm of the supernatural now, which is what you were trying to avoid. And you've placed yourself right back there. The devil had the body of Jesus right where he wanted it. Remember, the devil does not know what's going to happen. He's not omniscient, and he cannot tell what's going to happen in the future any more than we can. He is a finite being. Maybe he corresponds to the Archangel Michael in the converse. Maybe he does. So a very powerful being, but not one who knows everything. He's not the opposite of God, is my point. So he didn't know what was going to happen. If he had, maybe he wouldn't have had Jesus crucified. Yeah, exactly. That the devil was kind of shooting in the dark here, and now he's got Jesus right where he wanted him. He thinks that he's won. He bruised his heel, Genesis 3:15. For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also took part of the same, that through death the devil might destroy him that had the power of death. Through death Jesus might destroy him that had the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage, Hebrews 2:14. Again in Romans 6:9. Christ being raised from the dead dieth no more, death hath no more dominion over him. The devil wanted to keep him in the grave and not convinced everybody that he had risen. So again, I'll repeat a statement that I made this morning. The enemies of Jesus had no motive to move his body, and the friends of Jesus had no power to move his body. And yet, nobody has ever contended that the tomb was not empty, or that the body of Jesus was missing from the tomb. And nobody ever produced the body, except that Jesus had his body. He was out walking around in it. The fact of the resurrection, then, is not primarily a theological matter. It's a matter of history. It's a historical issue, primarily. And we know more about the details of these hours than any other fact of ancient history. Other historians talked about this. It's not just Bible. We have lots of post-resurrection appearances of Jesus, which have already been brought up. One of them included about 500 people at once. 500 people don't have the same hallucination all at once. And it wasn't just his friends. James, as we said this morning. James is one of the valuable witnesses here because the Lord appeared to James, and that seems to have been the thing that made the difference in James's life. So I think the silence of the Jews, to me, speaks as loudly as the voice of the Christians. The Jews avoided discussing the resurrection evidence. All they wanted to do was force people to stop talking about it, put them in prison, try to use all kind of tactics on them because they were in control of them. But they wouldn't have a debate about it. Indeed, what could they say? What could they say to these apostles who were totally changed men? Totally changed. So they just avoided discussing it. And that's always a sign of weakness in your position when you don't want to discuss it. That's true in every situation in life. What would you say to somebody who said maybe there was a secret entrance to that tomb? I had a girl say that one time. Yeah, it was built in it was a rock-hewn tomb, just carved out of rock. So if there's a secret entrance, the guy that owns it knows where that secret entrance is. And what good does a secret entrance do? I mean, tell me the Roman soldiers couldn't figure that out. The more we try to think through this, the more we see that there's no possibility for these answers.
Going into the dead man's tomb.
Right. They would have been unclean. That's right. I'm not going to go over too many of those because they just become too ridiculous. The only thing that really makes sense is what the Bible says. God raised him from the dead. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again. That was the prediction that Jesus had made. And that really, after you examine all these other theories, that becomes the easiest to believe and the thing that makes the most sense. God says Jesus was dead, he was wrapped, he was buried, there was a stone there, and the stone was sealed, and there was a Roman guard placed there, and I raised him from the dead in the face of all this. And I've given you the New Testament that you may know that, the eyes of your understanding being enlightened. What is the exceeding greatness of his power to usward who believe according to the working of his mighty power, which he wrought in Christ when he raised him from the dead and set him at his own right hand in heavenly places, far above all principality and power and might and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this world, but also in that which is to come. Neither is there salvation in any other. Jesus Christ said, "Who do men say that I am? And who do you say that I am?" He asked the question one time, "What think ye of Christ? Whose son is he?" He's the only religious leader of a major so-called world religion who has ever claimed to be deity and backed it up with works of mighty power. And he's the only individual who, even during his lifetime, has convinced a great portion of the people who met him that he is God. And after his earthly life was over, has convinced quite a portion of the world that he is God. How could a mere man make other people think that he was God? His teachings were ultimate, They were final. He never added any afterthoughts. He never made any revisions in what he said. He never retracted. He never changed it. He never guessed. He never supposed. And he never spoke with any uncertainty. This is all contrary to the way you and I teach. He used to be regarded by many people and many educated people as a mere myth, that he never really lived at all. 100 years ago, it was easy to find people who would say that Jesus never lived at all. He was just a figment. He was like Plato, or he was like Socrates. They would say Plato invented Socrates as a foil in his writings, and Socrates really never lived. And they would also say that Jesus Christ never lived. He was just a construct. But now we have all these records from other historians, uninspired historians. I don't know of anybody in our present time who says that Jesus Christ was merely a myth and never lived. For one reason, because to discard the Bible is not to discard all of the evidence. Secular history affirms that Jesus lived on earth and that he was worshipped as God. And as Kyle said, he founded a church that has worshipped him now for 2,000 years. And as we said this morning, he changed the course of the world's history. Just think of some of the statements that were made in the Gospels. Mark 14:61 and 62. Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? I am. That was considered blasphemy. This was the charge that caused the priest to rent his robes. Not the actions, but the identity of the accused man was the issue there. Jesus was condemned to death, not upon the statements of his accusers, although they didn't help him any, but mainly upon the admission that was made by him under oath. Answers like, thou hast said, or you say that I am, sound evasive to us. But there was no such connotation to the Jews. The courtesy of that time forbid a direct yes or no in a Jewish court of law. So what Jesus was saying is that what you're saying is right. That's exactly who I am. He claimed deity for himself in a way that everybody could recognize. They said, therefore, that by our law he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God. So the Jews understood what he was saying. When Jesus made statements like in John 10:30, I and my Father are one, the Jews took up stones. And he said to them, knowing why they were doing it, but he said, for which of my good works do you stone me? For a good work we stone thee not, but for blasphemy, because thou, being a man, makest thyself God. John 5:18. Therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him, not because he had not broken only the Sabbath, but said that he was, that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. John 8:58. Verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. Everybody knew what that I am meant, same as I am in Exodus chapter 3, when Moses was at the burning bush. Tell them that I am sent you. And now Jesus is claiming to be Jehovah God. From the reactions of the Jews, we can see that they understood his statement as a claim to absolute deity. He said things like in John 5:23 and 24, all men should honor the Son even as they honor the Father. What's he saying? He's saying he and his Father are in the same family, therefore they're both God. John 8:19, if you had known me, you should have known my Father also. John 14:1, if you believe in God, believe also in me. John 14:9, he that hath seen me hath seen the Father. In the Sermon on the Mount, we find Jesus teaching in his own name. He elevated his authority directly to heaven. Instead of saying, thus saith the Lord, he said, I say unto you. All the Old Testament prophets, virtually without exception, said, thus saith the Lord, thus saith Jehovah. Jesus said, but I say unto you. And he never hesitated, and he never apologized, and he didn't have any need to contradict or withdraw or modify anything he ever said. He spoke the unequivocal words of God without error. The Father giveth not the Spirit by measure unto him. John 3:34. So he said in Mark 13:31, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words shall not pass away. Jesus asked for and accepted worship. Worship as God. Leopards and blind men and disciples worshipped and adored him. Indeed, thou art the Son of God. Mark 14:33. Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. Hebrews 1:8. That was a statement made to the Son of God. Thomas said, my Lord and my God. And Jesus didn't correct him because he wasn't wrong. Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who have not seen and yet have believed. Jesus is contrasted with others in this glaringly. Cornelius falls at the feet of Peter, and Peter says what? Stand up. I myself am also a man. Acts 10:26. John falls at the feet of the angel, and the angel said, I'm your fellow servant. Worship God. Revelation 19:10. So Jesus, if he was not God, he's not even good, because he accepted worship as God. He made both direct and indirect claims to deity. He claimed to be able to forgive sins, and indeed did forgive sins right in front of the Jews. And they wanted to kill him for that. It was easy to say those things, of course, but he knew that he would get in trouble for saying them. In John 14:6, he declared himself to be the absolute final key to all the mysteries of the universe. I am the way, the truth, the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. I mean, what more do you have to say? That says it all right there. That he is claiming to have authority. He likened his followers' dependence on him to the sustenance derived from the vine by its branches. And he claimed authority. God gave Jesus authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man, John 5:27. All authority is given unto me in heaven and in earth. And it was a delegated authority from his Father, Matthew 28:18. So he said, ultimately, John 8:24, if you believe not that I am, you shall die in your sins. When you lift up the Son of Man, then shall you know that I am. I'll close with that old statement that you've probably heard before. Jesus claims to be God. His claims were either false or they were true. If his claims to be God were false, then he either knew that his claims were false or he didn't know that his claims were false. If he didn't know that his claims were false, then he was sincerely deluded. If he did know that his claims were false, then he made a deliberate misrepresentation and he was a liar. If he said, I am God, and it was correct, then he is the Lord. That's why, and this old trilemma that was stated by Josh McDowell and others before him many years ago, he was either Lord, liar, or lunatic. And it's up to us to make the choice in our personal lives as to whether we believe he was the Lord, a liar, or a lunatic. So somebody who is sincerely and honestly seeking for the truth about life has to confront this basic question of who is Jesus Christ. They have to answer that question that was asked so long ago. What shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ? That had to be answered by the man who asked it in the New Testament, and it has to be answered by every one of us as well. What think ye of Christ? And each of us needs to come to terms with that. What do you think about Jesus of Nazareth? He said, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not shall be damned. And so once again this afternoon, we're going to extend an invitation, never knowing the hearts of those present. If anybody has anything to bring before the assembled brethren this afternoon, let us know how we can assist you by coming to the front as we stand and sing the song that Ed's going to